I'm Debbie Wong and you're listening to the episode 4 of my podcast. I've been talking a lot about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, but I figured I actually have more to say about Bitcoin, and I kind of want to take my time and talk about different concepts before I actually jump to the other cryptocurrencies. So today's topic du jour is actually 51% attacks. And that's something that often comes back when we talk about cryptocurrencies, especially proof of work cryptocurrencies, because this is usually not an attack that exists in other type of cryptocurrencies. As a reminder, proof of work is this election mechanism that allows us to figure out who's the next person that can choose the next block of transactions to add to the blockchain. So in Bitcoin, you have this proof of work mechanism, and it says that it stops double spending because if you wait enough, you see people building on top of your block that contains your transaction. And so you know that there's not going to be another chain where your transaction is invalidated. And so you can actually do double spending. And if you didn't really understand my recap, I'll re-explain it here in a way that you can perform the attack. So imagine that you have most of the hashing power in the network. And by that, I mean that you own like these supercomputers and your friends are, you know, they own supercomputers as well. And basically most of the time, let's say 51% of the time or more, you guys end up mining the correct block. Or not the correct block, but you end up mining the block first. And so your block is chosen among other people's block because they're too slow to mine. And you know, the rest of the time other people mine, get lucky and mine the block, but most of the time you guys mine the block. So what you can do is that you can send a transaction to your Coinbase account, for example. So you receive the Bitcoin in your Coinbase account, you wait for some confirmation time, you know, and at some point Coinbase will be like, okay, we've seen enough block building on top of that block that contains your transaction. And so indeed you have 10 Bitcoin in your account. And now you go on Coinbase and you're like, okay, I want to withdraw these 10 Bitcoins. I'm going to exchange them against dollars. So you exchange that, you know, by maybe trading it with someone who wants to buy Bitcoins or like whatever. You get USD in your account and then you transfer that to your bank account in the, you know, Canary Islands or something like that. So now you have fiat money in your account. You have USDs and the Bitcoins you used to have disappeared. And basically Coinbase has given you money. So you spent it. Now, let's backtrack a bit. Something I didn't tell you is that when you submitted that transaction to the blockchain that moved your funds to the Coinbase address, which represents your account at Coinbase, when you did that, you also started mining another block that doesn't contain your transaction for the same height. So basically two contradicting blocks building on top of the same block. And you ask all your friends to do the same. And so when you mined the block containing the transactions going to Coinbase and people started building on top of that, right? You also mine another block, you and your friends, that doesn't contain that transaction. And then you continue to mine blocks on top of that block. And so by that, I mean that you're in a virtual private network with your friends and you're like, you're kind of like in a fork in like a different network and you're building this blockchain on top of that point of bifurcation that doesn't contain your transaction. And actually even worse, you submit a transaction to that local, you know, private blockchain or private fork, which moves your funds to your friend's address or like another one of your address. So it's not even there anymore. And you do that for like, you know, 6 blocks or even 10 blocks if you want, like you keep building on top of that. And once your money has left the Coinbase account, right? Once Coinbase has paid you, what you do is that you communicate, you publish that private blockchain, that private fork that you guys were working on. And so now what everybody sees is that most likely there's a new chain that bifurcated a while ago from that point on in the past. And that new chain is actually longer or has more work on it. There was more effort because you guys have most of the hashing power. So that's the correct chain. That's the canonical chain according to the rules of Bitcoin. And usually some other cryptocurrencies or protocols might call that the committing rule. That's how you know that it's committed, that these are the real blocks of the real blockchain. And so what happens is that you have a reorganization And all of that chain that people were building on top of, from the moment where you started your private chain, your private fork, is discarded, and everything is reorganized to follow your chain, the one that you were building in secret, that doesn't contain the transaction that you sent to Coinbase. And that's a double spending. Coinbase spent your transaction, you know, gave you USD in return that you cashed out in the real world. And yet now they have a blockchain that doesn't contain the transaction and they lost money, right? You ended up not giving them money. So you double spent the tokens that you had. So that's the double spending attack. And that's also a 51% attack where you used the fact that you have most of the hashing power to create a different fork and publish it as the true chain when you wanted people to reorg into that. So the interesting thing is that most new blockchains relying on proof of work are vulnerable to that attack because they don't have much hashing power on their chains. And so all of the miners from Bitcoin or other chains that have optimized their machines to mine efficiently on Bitcoin can take advantage of that and quickly go to the other chain and perform such attacks. So we've seen that, I believe, with ETC and a bunch of other cryptocurrencies where you had reorgs of like hundreds of blocks. So suddenly 100 of blocks were published and you had to change to that chain, which is quite remarkable. Some cryptocurrencies that still want to rely on proof of work, which I want to recall is quite an inefficient protocol, and I believe should kind of be dismissed in favor of more state-of-the-art protocols. But still, some cryptocurrencies want to rely on these older protocols. As we see in cryptography, for example, people still want to rely on RSA, even though most of the cryptographers and applications have moved to ECDSA or other signature algorithms like the one that Bitcoin uses. But some cryptocurrencies will also use RSA, which is an older sort of deprecated signature scheme. So anyway, I don't want to go too much into cryptography. To go back in proof of work cryptocurrencies, I just want to mention also that some cryptocurrencies decide to choose different hash functions that are very easy to compute, for example, so that all of the advantages that Bitcoin miners have are not really applying there and everybody has the same advantages because these hash functions are easy to parallelize and optimize and so on. And also just the fact that you're choosing a different hash functions means that all the hardware that was specialized for SHA-256, which is the hash function used by Bitcoin, doesn't apply to your hash function that you're using for your cryptocurrency. Oh, so by the way, I forgot to mention, but there's this cool app online called crypto51.app, APP, and basically tells you the attack costs if you want to attack a proof of work cryptocurrency. And so for Bitcoin, it says that, so Bitcoin uses the algorithm SHA-256. I'm reading what's on the page. And the hash rate is 200,000 something PH per seconds. I'm not sure what PH means, hashes, let's say. So it does a lot of hashes per seconds. That's what the network is doing, not a single individual. And so they say that if you wanted to attack the Bitcoin network for like an hour, meaning you're building blocks for an hour, and that's basically what you need to do a 51% attack, because an hour is usually the confirmation time, 6 blocks, then that would cost you only almost $800,000. So an attack is actually not that expensive. And depending on how much money you're stealing with your double spending attack, you might actually want to perform such a 51% attack on Bitcoin. To my knowledge, I don't think these attacks have happened in a while in Bitcoin, if ever, but they've definitely happened in a bunch of other cryptocurrencies. But just as a reference, if you look at Ethereum Classic, ETC, it's cost $30,000 to do a 1 hour attack. And Bitcoin Cash, $4,000. The Dash cryptocurrency, $1,000. And it gets worse. Again, if you want to check that out for yourself, it's the crypto51.app webpage. I don't know exactly how correct it is, but it's an interesting thing to think about. Another interesting resource is the 51% attacks page from the Digital Currency Initiative from MIT. And they list a number of 51% attacks that have happened. They say that since June 2019, they've actually detected over 40 reorgs that were 6 or more blocks deep on different coins. and the coins are actually things that I'm not aware of. But they talk about attacks on Litecoin and Bitcoin Gold and other coins that are actually pretty well known. Okay, so I'm done talking about 51% attacks. I don't want to spend too much time on that since I want to keep it under 20 minutes, and that's basically 10 minutes, I believe. So let's use the other 10 minutes to talk about Merkle trees. And that's somewhat important because Merkle trees are used all over the place in cryptocurrencies. I don't know any cryptocurrency that basically doesn't use that data structure, because it's a data structure. And so I think it's important to mention it at some point. It's a data structure that's actually hard to explain without a whiteboard or a diagram or an implementation or something like that. So I'm going to try and do my best in this podcast, but it is possible that you're not going to get everything if you don't already know what a Merkle tree is, and that you might have to, you know, grab for the internet and look for a diagram or something like that. So I'm going to try and use your imagination power and to try to explain that. But fundamentally, what is a Merkle tree first? Well, it's a data structure, meaning that you use that to store data. And it's also a cryptographic data structure, meaning that it's empowered by cryptography to provide some properties, I'm being very vague, that will prevent people from lying, let's say. That's the very high level explanation. Let me give you a lower level explanation. It's a vector commitment primitive. So basically, if you have a vector, and a vector is just, you know, a list of values of the same type. If you have a vector of values and you want to compress all of that into a tiny something and give that to someone else, you can do that using hash functions, right? You can hash all of your vector and send that to someone else. But then you cannot really prove to them that one of the value in your vector is contained in that digest. I'm going to start saying commitment is contained into that commitment. Without basically sending them all of the vector so that they can hash all of the vector and see that indeed it gives them the commitment. I've already explained what hash functions were, by the way, so I'm not going to explain that part. So what's interesting with these vector commitment schemes, so like a Merkle tree, is that it compresses all of that vector, right? It gives you like a tiny value that you can use to store somewhere to authenticate your entire vector. It's a commitment. And then if someone asks you if there is like some values in that commitment to your long list of values, you can give them short cryptographic proofs that indeed it is there. Okay, I hope that wasn't too crazy. Maybe I'll use another way of explaining it to pretty much say the same thing I just said. With an example, imagine you have your whole hard drive and you want to make sure that you can access folders in your hard drive without having to take your hard drive with you. What you can do is that you can give your hard drive to a friend and you can hash all of your hard drive using this Merkle tree, so this vector commitment, to get a small value, and you take that small value with you on like a USB key or something. So you're traveling, you're in Thailand, like on a beach or something like that, you have your USB key that has this identifier, this authenticator, this small value that is tied to the whole content of your hard drive. And then you ask your friend, okay, I actually need to query, I need to get the data which is in that folder. And your friend gives you the data that's in the folder, but no, they can also give you a proof that this is indeed the data that's in your folder, because the proof basically uses the fact that here's the data in your folder, and there is a path from that to the value that's on your USB key, that's the commitment to all of your hard drive. Okay, I hope that second example made more sense, but now I'm going to explain to you how this structure works, and maybe that will, I guess that's the third explanation, and maybe like that will reinforce things for you, and hopefully you will understand what a Merkle tree is from merely listening to someone rambling about it, which is quite a feat. So I'm not sure I'm gonna succeed, but let's see. So what you have to imagine is a tree. So we're going to build a tree where the vector of your values is, on the ground, and we're going to slowly go up, build our way up to a single value in the ceiling, let's say, in the sky, which is your commitment. Okay, so the values are in the bottom. Each value is basically split into, or each pair of values is separately seen as a pair. So let's imagine that you have four values in front of you. That's going to be easier. A, B, C, and D. And so A, B is seen as a pair on the left. C and D is seen as a pair on the right. And what you're going to do is that you're going to hash each pairs. So you're going to hash the value A and B on the left. It's going to give you a single value. And you're going to hash the value C and D on the right, which is going to give you a single value also. Let's call it the left value and the right value. So now we're on the next level of our tree, right? We're building up. Now we only have two values instead of four. We're going to take these two values and see that as a pair as well, hash them to obtain a single value. And now we're in the third level, and this is our root, the root of the tree. And this is the commitment to our entire tree. And so you can imagine a tree of like 8 elements or 16 elements and so on would follow the same principles where you're starting from pairs and you're hashing iteratively as you're going up to finish with a single value at the top. Kind of like a bracket in a tournament in soccer or something like that. And so you have different types of Merkle trees, by the way. Some of them are good if you're not filling all of the leaves at the bottom, these values in your vectors. Some of them could be empty, for example, or it could not be a perfect power of two or things like that. I'm not going to talk about these different types of Merkle trees that exist, but just know that they're out there. The other thing I need to explain is how do you create a proof? So imagine that I want to know that the value B is in the tree, right? You're giving me that value B, which might be the folder that you were looking for in your hard drive, and you have the root. So the question is, how do you recompute the root from that value B? So you can maybe you can pause the podcast if you want and try to imagine that in your head, but I'll give you the answer right away because I'm, you know, I don't have much time. Basically, what you need is all the neighbors on your way up to the root. And by that, I mean that in the beginning, you need to compute what's above B. And that's to do that, you need to hash A and B, right? And so to get the left value. And so to do that, you just need the value A. So you provide the value A or a hash of the value A, depending on how you're doing things. Maybe your leaves are hashes instead of values, which is common to do. And so you're hashing A and B to get the left value. So you provide A in your proof, right? You have to. Now that you have the left value, all is left for you to compute is the roots, but you need the right value to compute that. So the right value is the hash of C and D, but you don't need C and D, you just need the right value. So in the proof, you just provide the right value, which is better than providing C and D, right? It's only one value. And know that you are provided that right value, you can hash the left value that you computed with the right value, you obtain the root, and you compare that with the root that you had on your USB key in my previous example. And if it matches, then indeed that B value was in your Merkle tree, was authenticated by that commitment that you had kept on your hard drive. So that's basically a proof in a Merkle tree, in a very small Merkle tree, but you know, you can have bigger Merkle trees. And since you're dividing by two the values that you have at each level of your Merkle tree, these proofs are in a take logarithm space instead of, you know, linear space where you're sending all of the values in your tree so that they can recompute the root by themselves. Again, I want to mention that there's different types of Merkle trees. Some Merkle tree can hold a lot of values because they're sparse and might not contain some children sometimes. Some Merkle trees are optimized for being able to prove that some value is not in the tree and so on. So I'm gonna stop here. You're free to, you know, look at the literature of Merkle trees, but just know that every cryptocurrencies use Merkle trees in one way or another, and usually they're used to prove that a transaction was in the some block in a very short way, or in the case of some cryptocurrencies that an account has this amount of money in the state of all the accounts. But in the next episode, we'll see that Bitcoin doesn't do that. All right. So if you liked it, you know, share and subscribe like every podcaster seems to say these days. And I'll see you at the next episode.